tonight I'd like to talk about the other half, as Joseph mentioned this morning. We heard a lot about the wisdom, selfless aspect, the absolute, as we call it in the teachings. And there's a relative aspect which goes together with the absolute, actually. There's a real sense of understanding that as we begin to be less self-centered, much more spacious and open, from this quality of selflessness, there's a very clear possibility, potential to feel the interconnectedness. So we can understand that the less there's limitation, constriction, contraction within ourselves, the more there's a possibility to feel the weakening of separation. Separation within ourselves and separation from one another. And I think it's important to understand that this practice is for the benefit, the sake of living in this world in a wholesome way and sharing this human existence with other beings from the place of balance and peace, harmony. No doubt we've been looking into ourselves to clarify the aspects where there was probably some entanglement or ignorance, confusion. And therefore, we can sense that there's a great web or juxtaposition of our meditation practice and being part of this world. We're moving back into the world tomorrow. I don't know if you realize it. Some of you may not, you know. We're really going to pace up the rhythm a little bit and be able to meet each other in another way as the way that we have up to now. And so there's a really beautiful balance and harmonious way of bringing these two aspects together. One of the existential questions of being human is, how do we deal with the suffering that is in the world? We've been probably touching upon our own suffering, our own pain. All of us have had moments where we've been in contact, in connection with that suffering. And when we think of the world, there's so many levels. There's the personal suffering, there's the suffering in the community, and there's also, of course, the global suffering on this planet. Even it's said now that the earth itself is in pain, right? And we can sense the many, many ways that people are trying to find ways to heal the planet. Even though there's a lot of ignorance and denial of that being the case. It's amazing how the level of ignorance can also manifest at this level. No, there isn't really global warming, and no, there's no pollution in the air, and, you know, everything's fine. It's been like this a number of years ago. And you can sense, I mean, very clearly, if you're a little with wisdom in your mind, that there's things that can be improved that we could do and that are not being done. So this is a cause for some friction within ourselves, at least in me. If it's not in you, it's in me. How I sense a great potential for friction and even at times irritation, leading to a heightened sense of anger when I see certain causes that are not addressed. Issues that feel really important, maybe not today, but when you think of the future generations, you just wonder, you know, for what benefit? Well, probably for a very short-term benefit. So these are really ways that we can sense that the practice can touch so many aspects of life existence. So how do we bring what we learn on retreat into our lives? Well, in the very same way that we've been addressing, actually, our own sense of disconnect, hurt, wound, we will naturally place these same qualities of heart and mind, quality of presence, in relationship to what is happening outside of ourselves. Really remembering that life itself is a balancing act. It's not a given, and there is a balancing act which is needed. And where each of us perched upon a precarious pole, trying to stay centered in a very moving, swirling, swaying, breezing world full of wind, and it's out here. And so there's all these movements and rhythms, and we try to find some center with it all. These teachings have the power to expand our understanding through being more present and awake. This is their focus and orientation. They also encourage us to widen our focus to include how we relate to others, how we recognize our sense of interconnectedness rather than separation. And so many times when I speak of the practice or being on retreat to, for example, my family members, last time I spoke to was just a few days ago, actually, with my father who lives in Tel Aviv. And so I was speaking to him about what we're going to be doing for 10 days. And he says, but it seems so selfish staying on a cushion for just by yourself. And I said, well, you know, if you want to know about your mind and your heart and really know what's going on, you have to really look inside. And so I was trying to explain to him the purpose of our being in silence and being connected to face the heart and mind within. And after selfie, she says, it must require really a lot of courage. So he was really moving into the trying, at least, right, to understand the purpose. And it was quite beautiful to see that this 83-year-old man is asking questions since very few times, actually. I've been in this for quite a while. But it's very recent that he's kind of interested in really asking me, what am I actually doing? And even more so in Israel. You know, he says, here? And I said, well, yes, here. And so, of course, it raises his level of interest. There must be something interesting in this. So we might misunderstand the message and wrongly take it in. So this subtle interdependence of self and other, the Buddha emphasized it in quite a number of ways. And one of the ways that I'd like to express this is in the suttas. It's really one of the examples and little stories that I like from the Satipatthana Samyutta. He says, once in ancient India, a bamboo acrobat set up his bamboo pole in the center of a village, climbed up the pole with great flexibility, agility, and balanced carefully upon its tip. He then invited his young assistant to come up and stand on his shoulders, saying to her, you look after my balance, and I'll look after your balance, with us thus looking after one another and protecting one another, we'll show off our craft, receive some payment, and safely climb down to the bamboo pole, from the bamboo pole to the ground. That's more accurate. And the assistant says, no, no, master, that will never do. You must look after your own balance, and I will look after my balance. with each of us thus looking after ourselves and protecting ourselves, we'll show off our craft, receive some payment, and safely climb down the bamboo pole. So this, of course, in the teaching, illustrates the practice of mindfulness meditation. But this image of the balancing act works on so many levels to help understand what he was pointing to. There's a way that we need really to help ourselves before we can help another, to know the act of balance within ourselves. And this is exactly what we've been looking into, to receive rather than react, to release rather than cling, to be able to open rather than close. There's so many ways that this sense of balance can manifest also in our life. One of the aspects that is so important to remember is this physical sense of balance, to ground ourselves in the body. This body connection is so immediate and helps us in every single moment of our experience to stay connected. And it's often the first thing what can get in touch with, right? So there's no doubt that that strength may come up from this very fact of being here and now. From there, we can then maybe consider some balance in the mind. But the body is a place of connection, which is easy to come back to. And we can sense tonight the actual capacity to be more in touch with our own sense of inner being. If you think of how we are so used to projecting our attention into the world around us, into outside. And when we go back to the world, there's no doubt that we can sense that the inner shift to the outer shift requires an act of balance yet again. You'll be seeing tomorrow the possibility of moving constantly from inner life to outer life, connectedness, interconnectedness within and without, and the in-between between me and you, between one and another. So even though it was said there is no being, there is no self, therefore there is no other, right, in the absolute, there's no doubt that on the relative level there is a being, and hopefully there's a connection and a sense of a relationship. We relate to each other. So an inner life which meets another life, and that interconnectedness can happen in a very harmonious way, or it can happen through conflict, irritation, frustration. And if we base our life in awareness, there's no doubt that we'll have a greater consideration and an ability to have a balancing act whenever needed. So the acrobat, like the meditator, is bringing conscious awareness to a process that is always occurring and which we so often overlook. It takes a real vital first step to wish to stay connected within ourselves. I did a retreat with a Burmese master that's called Sayadaw Utejaniya, and he's quite known now in the West, and he comes from Burma, and quite a number of meditators from the West have practiced with him in the last years. And he taught at IMS, the center where Joseph has taught. And in these last encounters with him, he was really interested in noticing this act of balance, and people were asking about the interconnectedness, because in his way of teaching, he allows for people to have some connection through speech in the retreats, so that there's a sense of ability to feel the connectedness. And his advice is, you want to be really in relationship with another person, stay connected 60% to yourself, to what is happening, 40 outside. That's the appropriate process. Because then from that place of connection and to know what is exactly happening and relate from a place of harmony and balance, it's better to stay more on your side than project it outwardly. That's how we help each other. Based in a place where we deeply know and connect with our listening. So to listen to another, he was saying, listen first to yourself. Exactly what was Joseph saying last night in relationship to right speech, right? What is the intention before the action? So the acrobat's attention to his own kind of balance is motivated by the tender regard for the well-being of his beloved assistant. But there was a lack of wisdom. So there is this quality that we need the wisdom to be able to act from a place of compassion or kindness. And this wisdom we've been developing very deeply, actually. In a way, at least, it was exposed in a very deep way. And it's limitless, the wisdom that can be understood. But it also requires this very clear sense of compassion and tenderness of being. In another sutta, the Buddha speaks of a person mired in a quicksand. Caught in a quicksand? Yeah? You know what a quicksand is? And he cannot help another until he has himself reached firm ground, right? When you're completely... So our ability to help others depends on our own sense of groundness. And this is exactly what we've been doing in our practice here. Now, it's amazing how on airplanes, every time you get the safety, right? And they say how, if you have kind of security, safety, the oxygen mask, you put it on yourself before you secure another person. This is the message. This is exactly the image. To help another, you need to be helping yourself. And we've been doing just that. Absolutely that. After looking after oneself, we look after the others. So by practicing mindfulness, developing it, and making it grow, there's a sensitivity and a clarity that comes about. On the other hand, with patience, non-harming, loving kindness and compassion, we grow this capacity to include the relationship of good harmony and peaceful contact, connection. So it's said that there are two wings, right, in the Dharma, the wing of the wisdom and the wing of the compassion. In the same way that a bird needs the two wings to fly, we need two wings. So the dimension of compassion is extremely present. It's this quality of a heart that is able to stay open and caring, kind, wish well through the practice of metta, and also open to the pain that may exist in human life. With this, we are enabling the possibility, the potential for a more peaceful life, rather than stay in conflict and in separation. These two wings of wisdom and compassion balance each other. They strengthen each other. Now, as you know, metta is the wish to be able to see the good in oneself. And this is not easy. As I said so many times, and also Stephen, we've really been speaking together and how this harmony in relationship to self-judgment and the sense of being so negative about ourselves just is a way that we can sense the distancing and the separation. So the metta is exactly that quality that will help reach the heart, reach the mind, to be able to reconnect. It's about connectedness. And we can sense that slowly, slowly, this tender, caring quality can come about. Now, the compassion practice has definitely been also practiced in the Vipassana. How many times have you had a bodily sensation that was painful and that you were able to open to it, just very simply, just meeting it from that place of feeling it and resisting it a little less? It's said that the compassion is sweet. And that's so interesting, because it has the sweetness of aliveness, because it isn't separate from the pain. Therefore, there's a tenderness. And you can sense that if we're opening to the pain, we feel the tender heart. There's a way that the Pali word of karuna means, literally, it said, the quivering of the heart. There's a trembling, a very clear tenderness that manifests. And it can be poignant. Poignant meaning that it's includes the vulnerability, the sensitivity that a human being has. That quality of tenderness doesn't only happen for ourselves. It happens in relationship to being in the presence of another being's pain. And in that sense, interconnecting with a potential to be open and to receive and to listen to another. From that place, there's a sense of allowing. Sharon Salzberg, who Joseph mentioned, one of the founders of IMS, had taught in Russia 1 year, and she was translated. She spoke English and there was a translator. And the audience was kind of, as she was speaking, really kind of closing in and being more and more grim and not listening. And so to the point that she was kind of really shocked, and she asked the translator, "What are you describing when I'm saying the word compassion?" And he said, "Being overwhelmed by the sorrow, having a stabbing heart, and having the burden of someone's pain and carrying it and having the weight of that burden." And she looked at him and she smiled and said, "No wonder they look so miserable." So there's no way that this quality of compassion is not to feel burdened and overwhelmed by the pain. It's quite the opposite, actually, that we're opening and that we're able to have the capacity of a heart, because of the quality of metta, to receive the pain. So what she was coming up to was something which was in balance. And there's no doubt that to get to compassion, we may have many, many moments when it will feel overwhelming. And that's called grief or despair or a sense of pity. And it's part of the process. It really is part of what we're going to be meeting, because we're not just opening to suffering at once, right? So there's nothing wrong with that sense of despair or hopelessness, yet it's not balanced with wisdom, with acceptance. There's a form of aversion to the suffering and the pain. True compassion contains just no aversion. That's the only difference. But it's big. It's huge, actually, right? To not have aversion to the suffering. Deep compassion is connection. It's a base of mindfulness, understanding, and there's a sense of openness. I've been really quite touched, actually, and have been working with compassion for quite some years now. And really at the level of the heart, more than the mind saying what I want to mean by that, it's not through reflection, but really trying to bring the energy to the level of the heart, to really bring the energy down and feel the quivering of the heart, taking the teaching literally, and seeing how that place and space of connectedness can manifest to enable a sense of genuine metta or genuine compassion. And to me, it really is a process of exploration, which is so fascinating, because it's true. It's ordinary, and it can help. And it can really is a base for acknowledging and noticing, where am I at? You know, is there less suffering within myself? And when I am in relationship with other beings, is there a sense of greater ease in the presence of pain, whatever pain that may be? And no doubt we're often in the presence of pain. And I'd just like to offer, for me, it has been like going through three steps. And so the first step is the felt sense or the meaning that we can trust, that I can trust that we have what it takes to open to what is. That I have enough resources, the mindfulness and the potential to receive and to not fall into hopelessness or despair, and to bring along these qualities like kindness in relationship to the suffering. So not turning away, which is of course the very habitual reaction. Turning towards and trusting that we have the resources. The second step is further opening the heart to then stay open. Sustain that attention to be able to receive whatever effect of that pain is manifesting, not closing down on others. And, you know, so many times people can evoke strong emotions within ourselves. It's amazing. And so it's to stay firm. It's like, what does it take right now to stay in harmony and to stay balanced? And of course, from that place of ground of presence, in body presence, in the body, and not withdraw from that situation. What does it take? And so learning to stay open and to find balance. And it may be that we retreat, yet the engagement, the motivation is to stay open. It's heading towards working on not closing down, not withdrawing. And of course, this gets us to the third step, which is the ability then to consider the other person, and that's the act of selflessness, right? And put that other person, that other being in front of me and my need, or what I want to get from that person or that encounter. To really place that other person and not have a sense of what can I get in return. From that place, it's amazing what can happen. It's just so amazing. It's just, it's a whole open world that can manifest, which was not manifesting before, just because of the intention to stay focused on me rather than on the other. So this takes practice. It takes the dropping away of expectation. A big part of that interest is in relationship to giving rather than expecting. What can I give rather than what can I take? So that's another way of presenting the act of balance. So it's quite fascinating, because in relationship to what Sayadaw Tejinia was saying, putting more attention, 60% on ourselves and 40% on the outside, at a certain level, it's being present 60%. But to be able to do this three-step kind of way, you have to be connected. So in that way, you need to be in connection with yourself, and then hold the intention to allow for that flourishment to open and bring the other in our inner space and allow for that foundation to move. It's not a fixed balance. So wishing to benefit others, that's a very, very clear intention. We begin to sense the possibility of unconditional acceptance of what is. And that's the nourishment of the selfless attitude. The selfless attitude has unconditional acceptance, coming from confidence, tenderness, and kindness. And we're really taking care. And we can only do that with the really great sense of connection that we've been establishing here. I think it's the living experience of feeling at home, feeling at home in the present moment, feeling more and more at home, being in our own being with trust, that allows for that new field of exploration to manifest as we feel at home within our bodies, in our minds. We feel more at home in the world, whatever the world may offer. And as our kindness grows, definitely more for ourselves, kindness develops more for other people or beings. And therefore, it's a firm ground. In the same way that we build a house, there's a strong foundation, and it doesn't crumble. You know, it doesn't withdraw at the first difficulty. So this, of course, requires the support of mindfulness, this clear quality that we've been cultivating moment after moment. The Dalai Lama says, peace isn't an experience free of challenges. Don't think that peace is free of challenge. He says, it's an experience that's expansive enough to include all that arises, even the challenges, without feeling threatened. And so, what is being nourished, that quality of trust, is helping us to stay in contact, in connection, and less threatened. Really much less threatened, or maybe not threatened at all, when we engage and learn to be with ourselves. Now that is supported by this quality that we call equanimity. And the equanimity is, of course, this wonderful, beautiful quality that enables us to be in balance. It is the balance that I'm talking about since the beginning of the evening. To not crumble or fall or be thrown away by reactivity, attachment, or aversion. And the equanimity naturally grows as we practice mindfulness and we don't cling. Tartan Tulku says, compassion accepts others as they are. One who thoroughly realizes compassion no longer sees any separation between self and other. Compassion is the wholesome and spontaneous response to all situations. This is the practice, he says, when we learn not to separate ourselves, our feeling of connection within ourselves will grow, and it will grow with all that is living. So it's a process, right? It really is a process that requires time. There's a story here that I'd like to read. Maybe you've heard of the book from Mingyur Rinpoche. It's called The Joy of Living. It's a great book if you haven't read it. Tibetan Buddhism, okay? I just want to be sure. But it's got plenty of really interesting practices, and all in the field, you can say, of vipassana, nature of mind and compassion. He says, I have a Tibetan friend in India who lived next door to a man who had a bad-tempered dog. In India, unlike other countries, the walls surrounding the front yard of a house are very tall. The entrances to my friend's yard and his neighbor's yard were very close, and every time my friend came out of his door, the dog would come out of his neighbor's door, barking, growling. A scary experience for my friend. As if that weren't bad enough, the dog had also developed a habit of pushing through the door into my friend's yard, again barking, making a terrible disturbance. My friend spent a lot of time considering how to punish the dog for its bad behavior. At last, one idea popped in his mind. He opened the door to his front yard just a bit and loosely piling a few small heavy objects on top of it. The next time the dog pushed open the door, the objects would fall, teaching him a lesson. After setting his trap, one Saturday morning, my friend sat by his front window, watching and waiting for the dog to enter the yard. The dog never came. I went through the door. And all the papers fell on the friend's head. After a while, my friend set out his daily prayers text, and still the dog failed to appear. At a certain point in his chanting, my friend came to a very ancient prayer of aspiration known as the Four Brahma Viharas, which you know well, right? He said, may all sentient beings have happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering. In the middle of the chanting, of course, it suddenly occurred to him that the dog was a sentient being and that having deliberately set a trap, he would bring pain to this being. If I chant this, he thought, I'll be lying. Maybe I should stop chanting. But that didn't feel right, since the prayer was part of his daily practice. He started the prayer again, making an effort to develop compassion towards the dogs. But halfway through, he stopped himself. No, that dog is very bad. I just cannot. I don't want him to be free of suffering. See how much sincerity there is in this man? I mean, it's amazing. You can sense the process of the practice happening in him. He thought about his problem for a while until a solution finally came to him. He could change one small word of the prayer. May some sentient being speak. It's so honest. He felt quite happy with this solution. After he'd finished his prayers, eaten his lunch, and forgotten about the dog, he decided to go out for a walk. It was, to say the least, a rude awakening when he realized the situation he was in. But he realized something of great importance. By excluding any beings from the possibility of achieving happiness and freedom from suffering, he had also excluded himself. Recognizing that he himself was the victim of his own lack of compassion, he decided to change his way. The next day he went out for his morning walk and had a piece of bread, made a ground, it's tsampa, it's a Tibetan bread. As soon as he came out, the dog appeared, rushing out and barking, but instead of cursing the dog, my friend simply threw him the piece of tsampa. Completely surprised, in mid-flight, the dog caught the tsampa in his mouth and began to chew. This little game continued over the next several days, and what my friend noticed, that even though it kept growling while chewing on the tsampa, the dog started to wag its tail. By the end of the week, the dog was no longer bouncing out ready to attack, but instead greeted my friend with a really kind attitude. Eventually, the relationship between the two developed to the point where the dog would come trotting quietly into my friend's yard to sit with him in the sun while he quietly recited his prayers. So this is a very sweet story, no? But no doubt, it's just a way of noticing how we can stay so constricted, so contracted in our heart, and stay with our self-righteousness. And find so many ways, right, to block ourselves from the obvious attitude, which is to open, to have a sense of kindness, of interconnectedness. So this is what we've been looking at. Kindness toward ourselves. And this kindness, this care, this compassion, even if we've been feeling hurt and probably a lot of hurt at times, wounded, and touched upon our scars, there's a possibility of another attitude. And we've been really noticing probably some insights have emerged from the proximity, the connection that we've been established with ourselves. This very same attitude of slowly opening to what is, rather than resisting and reacting, like this Tibetan man, is to be flourished and to be remembered in relationship to whatever situation will come in your life. It's the very same attitude that we are bringing into our life. And this doesn't require a belief. You know, when the Dalai Lama says the essence of all religion is love, compassion, tolerance. Tolerance is just so huge, to be able to be tolerant. Another person's not having the same view as I, and we can still be open. And so when he said, the Dalai Lama, kindness is my true religion, there is no need for temples, no need for complicated philosophy. My philosophy is kindness. And it's quite amazing that really lately he's probably feeling the contraction that is in this world. Every time he speaks to people, this dimension is underlined more and more often because there's a need for it. Because there's definitely a need for it. And so, to not overlook that simple care and kindness that we've been developing. If we want the world to be a kinder place to live in, it begins with ourselves. And that's the wisdom that we've been learning. This is, for me at least, a very clear potential for a wise direction where we hold the bigger picture and we see that it can only begin with our own sense of at least potential to look and to aspire to be kind. So much of the time we're waiting for kindness from the outside. And there are days when you wake up and you're really open, you come out of your door, wherever you live, and you have a smile on your face. And it's amazing how people respond, and there's a sense of connection, and there's a contact. Days when we're all grim, and definitely there's another living experience. So it begins, at least to a certain extent. It's not that simple, but it's no doubt that it begins with looking at our own attitude. So much of the time, the meditation has changed me at that level. If I can say, for, you know, practicing for quite a number of years, there's one thing that I can be sure of, is that I'm a much more open and kind person than I used to be. And that's big. It's really quite extraordinary, actually. And by being more kind and more open, there's definitely a sense of greater happiness, a lightness of heart, a lightness of being. The Buddha often talked of kindness also as restraint, meaning that the ethical living, sila, occupies also a central place in the Buddha's teachings. As we've been seeing, there's a field of conscious conduct which pays off. We pay attention, as was mentioned last night, to our actions and our speech. And every time we do, we can maybe have a sense of restraint when we will harm through action or speech. And therefore, in that place of not divorcing, not separating our spiritual practice from everyday action, there is here a huge place for growth. We can always try to enable a sense of growth in relationship to how we respond, act, and behave in relationship to action in body, speech, and mind. Actually, the Buddha, it's really nice in the sutra, he says, sila, or ethics, if you want conscious conduct, is the true beauty of a person. It manifests as beauty because the person is in peace and will manifest that peace outwardly, and this beauty will show in relationship to a mind that is peaceful from an appropriate conduct. Nothing that we can blame ourselves for. So we can watch the effect of our actions on our mind. And here again, it's a practice. And it's a practice that we can do daily. It's so easy to bring that aspect in our lives. You know, every time we get angry, we practice anger. Every time that we get a lot of resentment, we practice resentment. Every time that we do a generous act, we practice generosity. It's as simple as that. What is manifesting, this is what is growing. And so it's not about, you know, perfection, but to recognize and acknowledge that the quality of our heart and mind strengthens according to what we cultivate and what we grow. So So what is the quality of our mind when we talk to people? And to look. This is exactly where we can look, and what is our motive. We can check the attitude in the mind in the same way that we've been doing this in relationship to what is present within. And we can also see that when we speak or act, how does the other person respond? It's so wonderful when there's that place of interconnectedness to notice the effect of our being, how we are, how our own behavior affects another person, and the energy that comes out of that other person. Often, when being with another, we're so caught up with our own stories that we're not really in relationship. So that's the first step that we can take. And it requires a tremendous sense of awareness. There's no doubt that it requires time, space, presence, and yet there's so much payoff. There's so much reward, gratification in this field. Chala Joko Beck, again the Zen teacher, she says, practice is stated very simply. It is moving from a life of hurting myself and others to a life of not hurting myself and others. Mm-hmm. It's so simple. Mm-hmm. And of course, the precepts here are very good guidelines. They're very simple, actually, but they're not easy to apply. Really, when you think of them, they sound simple, but if you pay attention to them, they can be very, very profound. And it's said that a Sri Lankan monk said, if one were just to engage with the five precepts deeply and wholeheartedly, this would be the whole path in relationship to living a wise and harmonious life. It requires a lot of mindfulness, actually, to live with the precepts. And they purify the greed, the hatred, and delusion. So we cultivate them. We're really doing our best. I find it very helpful to have one and for a time to really practice with one. As I think Joseph was mentioning, with right speech. And I've also been doing this with really practicing. Speech is just... It can always improve. It's so easy to speak wrongly. You know, it's so automatic. It's so quick. We rush with speech, and there's so much happening afterwards. Usually we regret what we said. We have to repair. We have to make up for what we said. Even now with email contact, you know, you write something on an email and it's kind of this form, which is so quick. And it's so misunderstood what you said. That's absolutely not at all what I meant, you know. There was absolutely no wrong intention. And yet the other person understood completely differently. So to have a second look, to really reread the emails. Now I reread each email that I write, which has a certain content, not just information, but a content with... and to say, okay, how can this be read, and how can it be received, and to be sure that there's nothing in it that could be misunderstood. It's a practice. This is exactly what I've been doing with right speech, and it's been helpful, because a lot of the time before doing that, I'd have to take the phone, take the time to repair, to just, you know, clarify, and you know what I mean, right? So in our life, the practice can touch so many domains, so many areas. Create mindfulness bells. So sila, the last aspect that I'd like to speak about is the aspect of dana, which is, of course, shifting from a self-centered view to this expression of openness. quality of dana, of generosity, which is just basing our life on the other rather than ourself? What can I offer to the world rather than get from the world? And it's the greatest practice because it touches upon the wisdom in relationship to letting go. It's non-attachment. So every time you do little acts of giving, you practice the deepest wisdom, letting go. And my own teacher, Dogo Khyentse Rinpoche, would really insist on this. Tibetan teacher. He would really give so long talks and a lot of really lengthy Dharma teachings on generosity in the same way that the Buddha did before actually giving the wisdom teachings. And there was a purpose to that because it's so much more easy and for people to be able to give than to practice the non-attachment. And giving, offering is the practice of letting go. To think of another, to really practice this sense of connectedness through what we can offer requires that we explore this dimension of not being so self-centered. And so the Dalai Lama says this, when we practice initially as a basis, we control ourselves, stopping the bad actions which hurt others as much as we can. This is defensive, he says. After that, when we develop certain qualifications, then as an active goal, we should help others. In the first stage, sometimes we need isolation while pursuing our own inner development. Exactly what we've been doing. However, after you have had some confidence, some strength, you must remain with contact and serve society in any field you wish. Health, education, family, whatever. So it's really not about just staying centered and thinking that the practice is formal on a cushion. It really is a practice which aids us in every single domain of our life. And the more we purify our mind, the more we strengthen this non-attachment, we make a habit of giving. And of course, this weakens the craving, the root cause of suffering. And any reduction in it can only lead to greater happiness. That's what's so great. It's so beautiful. Shantideva says, whatever joy there is in this world all comes from desiring others to be happy. And whatever suffering there is in this world all comes from wanting pleasure for myself. So there's a really beautiful way of moving from this self-centered attitude which leads to tension and suffering to a greater openness, balancing act within ourselves, a fullness of being which finds the ease and the comfort and the trust, the unconditional acceptance of living in this more open field of awareness. And from that space of fullness of being, another is just as important as our being. And the sense of self and other drops away. And the action is just the action, as was mentioned last night. So the biggest gift I feel that we can offer to others is the development of our own spiritual growth, what we've been nourishing. And that we can have the aspiration to offer this beautiful quality of heart and mind that we've been cultivating, the insights, the kindness, the compassion, the mudita, the equanimity, all these wonderful qualities. May they flourish in your life. Gandhi said, I believe if one person gains spiritually, the whole world gains that much. Isn't that great? And if one person fails, the whole world fails to that extent. So we've been definitely putting our efforts and have had a lot of courage in relationship to spiritual growth. So trust that the world has gained that much. I'd like to close with a poem from Mother Teresa. She says, the success of love is in the loving. It is not in the result of loving. Of course, it is natural in love to want the best for the other person. But whether it turns out that way or not does not determine the value of what you have done. It is not how much we do, but how much we love, how much love we put into the doing. It is not how much we give, but how much love we put in the giving. If we really want to love, we must learn how to forgive. We can do no great things, only small things with great love. Doing small things with great kindness. And just a last line from the Dalai Lama. He says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And then go out and do that, because what the world needs is more people who come alive. And we've been definitely trying to be more alive. And I hope you feel that. So that's what the world needs. So let's sit for just a minute.